Judas hung Nicanor's head from the citadel, a clear and conspicuous sign to everyone of the help of the Lord. And they all decreed by public vote never to let this day go unobserved, but to celebrate the 13th day of the 12th month, which is called Adar in the Aramaic language, the day before Mordechai's day.
Welcome to 15 Minute Maccabees. I'm Meir Soloveitchik.
Of all Jewish fast days, the one that may seem initially utterly incongruous is now known as Ta'anit Esther, the Fast of Esther, marked on the 13th day of Adar preceding the festival of Purim. We are informed that Mishenichnas Adar Marbin Bisimcha, that joy must increase as we enter the month of Adar, and yet Purim itself is preceded with petition and prayer, joining fast to feast. For Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik, this is not actually incongruous at all, but utterly apt. For there are two facets to Purim. One is a tale of salvation, of the defeat of Haman and his genocidal forces. But there is another aspect to the story. The tale told in Esther is of a Jewish community that felt secure when suddenly an enemy arose against it, a reminder of the fact that there are constantly threats to the Jewish people. That is why, Rabbi Soloveitchik argued, Esther's story is not only a tale of triumph. It is also, as he put it, quote, the book of vulnerability of man in general and specifically of the vulnerability of the Jew, end quote. This theme of vulnerability is part of Purim and it justifies not joy, but fear. However, because fasting is forbidden on Purim itself, as it is marked by celebration, therefore the fast precedes the feasting festival. As Rabbi Soloveitchik writes, quote, as a matter of fact, the whole institution of the Fast of Esther rests upon this very dichotomy inherent in the festival of Purim, upon the paradoxical halachic requirement that Purim be observed both as a day of prayer and as a day of joyous celebration. Since it is impossible to comply with the paradoxical requirement, the rabbis advance the observance of the prayer aspect of Purim to the 13th of Adar, end quote. All this is absolutely true, and yet we must remember that the tradition of fasting on the day before Purim is not mentioned in the Talmud and seems to have developed after. Strikingly, in the period of the Second Temple, the 13th of Adar was itself a day of joy and celebration, not because of the Purim tale, but rather because of the story surrounding Chanukah. And when we learn of that original festival, we are actually existentially aware of how its story only enhances Rabbi Soloveitchik's insight about the awareness of the vulnerability inherent in Jewish history and the obligations that are bound up with that awareness. As we saw, Lysias the regent and the young king Antiochus V, having dealt defeat to Judah and wreaked havoc in Jerusalem itself, departed to Antioch in order to head off the challenge for the regency by Philip. In the end, all the contesting was to be in vain, for the claim of Antiochus V himself to the throne was contested by Demetrius, the son of Antiochus IV's older brother Seleucus. Demetrius seized power in Antioch in the year 162 BCE and was then approached by a Hellenist Kohen named Alcimus, who was seeking, like Jason, around a decade before to become the high priest. Demetrius sent his general Bacchides to install Alcimus, who himself persecuted more traditional Jews, Jews called by the text Chasidim, or pious ones. This is the version of the story in the first book of Maccabees. Quote, then a group of scribes appeared in a body before Alcimus and Bacchides to ask for just terms. The Hasideans were first among the sons of Israel to seek peace from them, for they said, a priest of the line of Aaron has come with the army, and he will not harm us. And he spoke peaceable words to them and swore this oath to them, we will not seek to injure you or your friends. So they trusted him, but he seized 60 of them and killed them in one day. End quote. In order to keep order in Jerusalem and to ensure the failure of Judah, another Seleucid general was sent by Demetrius, named Nicanor. In some texts, an uneasy truce is described as originally existing between Nicanor and Judah, before Judah, understanding that Nicanor plans to harm him, flees from Jerusalem. Nicanor vows to defeat Judah and warns Jerusalem that, if Judah remains undefeated, he, Nicanor, will take his anger out on the sacred city itself. Here is the description in 2 Maccabees, which is paralleled in other versions of the story. Quote, after these events, Nicanor went up to Mount Zion. Some of the priests came out of the sanctuary and some of the elders of the people to greet him peaceably and to show him the burnt offering that was being offered for the king. But he mocked them and derided them and defiled them and spoke arrogantly. And in anger, he swore the oath, unless Judas and his army are delivered into my hands this time, then if I return safely, I will burn up this house. And he went out in great anger. Then the priests went in and stood before the altar in the temple and they wept and said, thou didst choose this house to be called by thy name, and to be for thy people a house of prayer and supplication. Take vengeance on this man and on his army, and let them fall by the sword. Remember their blasphemies, and let them live no longer. End quote. The battle was joined between Judah and Nicanor at a site called Adassa. According to 2 Maccabees, Judah in a vision saw Jeremiah presenting a sword to him as a sign of victory preceding the battle. The story is striking because it shows how Jeremiah was seen in the Second Temple period, not only as the prophet that had foreseen the destruction of Jerusalem by Babel, but also the prophet guaranteeing, in a time of trial, the Jewish people's endurance. As Rabbi Sacks once reflected, quote, Jeremiah, the most passionate and tormented of all the prophets, has gone down in history as the prophet of doom, yet this is unfair. He was also supremely a prophet of hope. He is the man who said that the people of Israel will be as eternal as the sun, moon, and stars. He is the man who, while the Babylonians were laying siege to Jerusalem, bought a field as a public gesture of faith that Jews would return from exile. End quote. Both 1st and 2nd Maccabees, however, have Judah referring before battle in his prayerful address, not to the age of Jeremiah, but of Isaiah, and not to Babel, but to another enemy of Israel, Assyria. Here is the version in 2 Maccabees. Quote, Maccabeus observing the masses that were in front of him and the varied supply of arms and the savagery of the elephants, stretched out his hands toward heaven and called upon the Lord who works wonders. For he knew that it is not by arms, but as the Lord decides that he gains the victory for those who deserve it. He called upon him in these words, O Lord, you sent your angel in the time of King Hezekiah of Judea, and he killed fully 185,000 in the camp of Sancherib. So now, O sovereign of the heavens, send a good angel to spread terror and trembling before us. By the might of your arms, may these blasphemers who come down against your holy people be struck down. With these words, he ended his prayer. And the text continues. Nicanor and his troops advanced with trumpets and battle songs, but Judas and his troops met the enemy in battle with invocations to God and prayer. So, fighting with their hands and praying to God in their hearts, they laid low at least 35,000 and were greatly gladdened by God's manifestation. When the action was over and they were returning with joy, they recognized Nicanor lying dead in full armor. Then there was shouting and tumult, and they blessed the sovereign Lord in the language of their ancestors. Then the man who was ever in body and soul the defender of his people, the man who maintained his youthful goodwill towards his compatriots, ordered them to cut off Nicanor's head and arm and carry them to Jerusalem. When he arrived there and had called his compatriots together and stationed the priests before the altar, he sent for those who were in the citadel. He showed them the vile Nicanor's head and that profane man's arm which had been boastfully stretched out against the holy house of the Almighty. He cut out the tongue of the ungodly Nicanor and said he would feed it piecemeal to the birds and would hang up these rewards of his folly opposite the sanctuary. And they all, looking to heaven, blessed the Lord who had manifested himself, saying, Blessed is he who kept his own place undefiled. Judas hung Nicanor's head from the citadel, a clear and conspicuous sign to everyone of the help of the Lord. And they all decreed by public vote never to let this day go unobserved, but to celebrate the 13th day of the 12th month, which is called Adar in the Aramaic language, the day before Mordechai's day. End quote. So the second book of Maccabees gives us this story. Interestingly, the descriptions in both 1st and 2nd Maccabees tell us little of the strategy utilized by Judah against what was clearly, by numbers, a superior force. And only a small hint as to how victory was won can be found in Josephus, who wrote over two centuries later. Josephus tells us of the death of Nicanor in the battle. Quote, Upon whose fall the army did not stay, but when they had lost their general, they were put to flight and threw down their arms. Judas also pursued them and slew them and gave notice by the sound of the trumpets to the neighboring villages that he had conquered the army, which, when the inhabitants heard, they put on their armor hastily and met their enemies in the face as they were running away and slew them insomuch as not one of them escaped out of this battle, who were in number 9,000. This victory happened to fall on the 13th day of that month, which by the Jews is called Adar and by the Macedonians Dystrus, and the Jews thereon celebrate this victory every year and esteem it as a festival day. From Josephus' version, which seems to have different numbers as to the defeated enemy, we can perhaps deduce elements of Judah's strategy. In seeking to kill Nicanor himself, Judah achieved a collapse of confidence on the part of the Seleucids, and conversely, a massive surge of enthusiasm from Jews that had until then not yet joined the battle. Such a successful strategy does not, of course, take away the importance of providence in this victory, a providence recognized by Judah himself. And from the way in which Josephus was writing, it is clear that what was called the Day of Nicanor, marked as a holiday before Purim on the 13th of Adar, was celebrated for decades after the death of Judah the Maccabee himself, that it was marked even in Josephus' own age. Thus, as I've mentioned in Jerusalem 365 in discussing this story, several enormously interesting aspects emerge from a study of this episode. Judah compares his victory against a massive infantry with elephants to one of the great miracles in Jewish history, when the Assyrian army surrounded Jerusalem, and an angel of the Almighty went out and struck the Assyrian army dead. The victory of the Hasmoneans over Nicanor is seen as another miraculous miracle all to itself. And that is why the ultimate defeat of this Nicanor became the source of a holiday. For us today, the 13th of Adar is a day of fasting and prayer. It is the day before Purim, Ta'anit Esther. But as we now understand, this was originally a day of celebration of its own, the day of Nicanor, which preceded what is called in many early texts the day of Mordechai. This means that for several centuries, a Seleucid general and Haman were joined together in infamy, as Jews celebrated the downfall of one and then the downfall of the other. The question, of course, is what happened to the festival known as the Day of Nicanor? If Josephus is correct that this was marked joyously throughout the Second Temple period, why do Jews not mark it today? The answer given by the Talmud is that this festival is one of the many once marked listed in the Second Temple work known as Megillat Ta'anit, days which ceased to be celebrated following the catastrophe that was the fall of Jerusalem and the destruction of the Temple in 70 CE. But the Talmud does itself remember the events surrounding the day of Nicanor and gives us a very similar story. And I quote one translation from Tractate Ta'anit. The Talmud asks, "What is Nicanor's day?" And the Talmud answers, "It has been taught. Nicanor was one of the Greek generals. Every day he waved his hand against Judah and Jerusalem and exclaimed, 'When shall it fall into my hands that I may trample upon it?' But when the Hasmonean rulers proved victorious and triumphed over him, they cut off his thumbs and his great toes and suspended them from the gates of Jerusalem as if to say, 'Of the mouth that spake arrogantly, of the hands that were waved against Jerusalem, may vengeance be exacted.'" End quote. This then is the Talmudic version. But there is more to add here, especially in the time and age in which we find ourselves. The truth is that the theme once marked on the festival of the 13th of Adar and the theme marked today on the fast of the 13th of Adar go hand in hand. For the fast of Esther that is observed today on this date reminds us, as Rabbi Soloveitchik noted, of how threats to the Jewish people can suddenly present themselves. That is something in this moment we elementally understand. The corollary is the lesson that is reflected in the story surrounding the events of the 13th of Adar in the age of the Maccabees, that the Jewish people must act against its enemies and defend itself against its enemies. Thus, as we near the end of Hanukkah, we remember a victory of Judah that took place after the purification of the temple, that is the essence of the Hanukkah story. And remembering Judah's victory, we pray for a swift victory for the IDF, the heirs to the Maccabees that fight at this very moment. This is Meir Soloveitchik wishing you a luminous and meaningful Hanukkah, signing off.